just thinking I'm quite used to coming after Deva Mitra because, as we are both two Shabda stalwarts and it's alphabetical, I usually follow him in Shabda. And chemo brain or not, I'm astonished and impressed at your amazing fluidity. And my memory is just porridge, not chemo, but just porridge, so I'm going to have to read this. These are personal talks. This is a very personal talk, a bit of a mishmash. It isn't at all the sort of thing I usually talk about, so I was quite surprised to be asked to do this, and it did feel a bit kind of difficult, actually. So that seemed quite a good reason to have a go at it. But as it happens, I had quite an interestingly odd initial experience of the lines of acceptance. For starters, I had never even heard of them before my ordination retreat. I had absolutely no idea about them. I had a fairly okay memory then, so it wasn't I'd just forgotten about them. I had definitely not heard about them. I don't know how I'd managed that. But actually, a few people I asked about it, because of doing this talk, didn't remember hearing about them before their retreat either. So I did vaguely wonder if they kind of were kept a little bit quiet before the retreat in case you freaked out. Because I remember when I first heard about them on the retreat, particularly this fourth one, I thought, hang on a minute, this sounds like bodhisattva vows. Now, I didn't sign up for this. This is way too much. I can't do this. And I did actually feel a little bit freaked out by it. I felt as if I'd signed up for something that I finally felt confident and competent enough to really fully embrace, and had suddenly discovered I'd missed a bit of small print that said, oh, by the way, you've got to save the world. Because it really did feel like that big of an ask. Also, my journey to ordination was a struggle. It was a very interesting and informative and rewarding struggle, but it was a struggle. And it took quite a long time. And while I knew that ordination was the beginning of a new adventure rather than the end of something, and I did know I couldn't just put my feet up after that, I think I was rather looking forward to a nice cup of tea and a sit down for a bit. So I was a little bit thrown by this kind of idea, this huge new thing that seemed to demand a lot of energy. But luckily I was so blissfully happy, deeply happy to be getting ordained, that I didn't get up and run away. And then something really interesting happened in our public ordination ceremony, which, as I'm sure you all remember, is a wonderfully joyous, fabulous occasion. And after the ceremony, you know, there's that lovely bit where everyone else has gone and it's just new ord members are left sitting there. And you're sitting there in your new queso and just feeling completely blissed out. It's a very nice time, that. And then the door suddenly opened and our public preceptor bustled back in and said, well, no one's perfect, including me. I forgot something. But it's okay, we'll do it now. And it turned out we had never actually done the lines of acceptance. So, it was very, very funny. And I just loved that it happened. And I felt even fonder of that public preceptor. And the funny thing was, though, that the ceremony had been so absorbing and kind of happy-making that I don't think any of us realised that we hadn't done it. I certainly had no idea we hadn't done it. So it just made, you know, it wasn't, I was sitting there thinking, phew, got away with that then. So it just made the whole thing extra special, really. So as well as having had this rather funny, hiccupy start with the lines of acceptance, I still have a slightly wobbly relationship with this particular line. Because even though I do know it's not about me having to save all beings, and it doesn't even say save but benefit, it's still a big thing to say and mean. And I did mean it when I said it. although I don't think I really understood what it meant. And I still don't fully understand it a lot of the time. So it's an ongoing, it's not, well, not exactly a koan, but it's something I suppose I struggle with a little bit. I don't even struggle with it really. It's just, I think I have a lot of different feelings about it. I'm just going to read this very funny, I think, poem. I don't approve of trigger warnings. I don't think they're in accord with reality. However, I am going to give, just mention that the F word occurs in this. And I'm going to read it because I do not consider quoting as breaking speech precepts. And I think leaving it out or substituting some other word is a bit insulting to the author. So anyway, you've had the warning. This is by Albert Saijo. And it's called Bodhisattva Vows. Bodhisattva vows to be the last one off the sinking ship. You sign up and find out it's forever. Passenger list endless. Ship never empties. Ship keeps sinking, but doesn't quite go under. On board, angst, panic and desperation hold sway. Turns out Bodhisattva is a fucking job like any other, but different in that there's no weekends, holidays, vacations, no golden years of retirement. You're spending all your time and energy getting other people off the sinking ship into lifeboats bound gaily for nirvana, while there you are, sinking. And of course, you had to go and give your life jacket away. So now, let us be cheerful as we sink. Our spirit ever buoyant as we sink. So I know, we know, and of course he knows, that that isn't actually the way a bodhisattva feels. But occasionally, on a bad day, I can feel a little bit like that. And I can't find a reference to this, so I may have imagined it, but I seem to remember being told that Banti very clearly said that the altruistic dimension of going for refuge is not optional for order members. And that can feel like a bit of a pressure, because not optional can sound as if it means you've got to keep at it full steam all the time, a bit like that poem. It does sound terribly tiring, really. Whereas I think what it really means is that altruism is such an inherent aspect of going for refuge at ordination level that you need to be doing something altruistic whenever you possibly can, or your going for refuge won't hold together so well. So if, say, the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, are the warp of a fabric, which are the long, strong threads that go through the whole length of fabric, the warp. If they're the warp of the fabric, then the weft that's interwoven back and forth is the altruistic dimension. And the weft is what holds the warp together. So in a way, you could say that the altruistic dimension is what holds your going for refuge together. And if that, you know, it doesn't mean you have to go bananas about it, but if you don't have that going on to some extent, then your going for refuge could fall apart a bit, or at least get a bit floppy. But it's important to remember that the weft can be very different strengths and thicknesses and colours and kinds of thread. So we just need to do the best we can, whenever we can, and in whatever way works best for each of us, with our variety of different abilities and skills. And because we have different skills and abilities, we also need to use a bit of wisdom about how much we do and what we do. Because while it's quite true that, as Maya Angelou said, nothing will work unless you do, if you overwork so that you get ill or exhausted, well, you're not going to be able to do any work, so nothing will work. And I think historically we have a slight tendency to do that in Triratna. I mean, I remember a time when things like ME and chronic fatigue syndrome were referred to as FWBO disease. You know, with aircraft safety instructions, there's a reason that you are told to put your own life mask on before your child's. Because if you don't look after yourself, you are not going to be able to look after anyone else. You can't help any other beings. And though there's often a shortage of people to do things particularly in True Ratna, actually, that's very true of us and in our centres and things. There often is a bit of a shortage. And of course, generosity and the willingness to help should be hugely appreciated. But I don't think it's ultimately really helpful to have people doing things they're not cut out for, they don't have the skills or temperament for. I don't think it's helpful for them or for the situation. So we just need to be realistic about what we do in both those ways, you know, what and how much. But having said that, I think it is true that in order to fully inhabit your order being, you do need to do some altruistic activity. I mean, I've noticed that if I haven't been doing anything for others for a while, which has occasionally happened if I've gone on a really long holiday and solitary even, or as more recently when I spent most of a year just dealing with the aftermath of an accident, I start to feel just slightly odd. I don't quite, it's almost like I don't feel odd at the time, but then when I start doing things again, I think, oh, yes, this is what it is, it's normal. And it's something about, I don't really feel like Dhammagita unless I'm being Dhammagita. And it is somehow, being Dhammagita just does involve some kind of trying to benefit beings. I suppose after a while it becomes second nature, doesn't it? So it doesn't feel quite right if you're not doing it. And the whole altruistic model of the Bodhisattva ideal, you know, is so central to the whole idea of the order, which is why our symbol is the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, which we haven't actually got around, but you all know it. And even this sometimes feels kind of a bit much to me, because it's such a huge, extraordinary, shiny, golden ideal. And most of the time, I feel like a very small, very ordinary, very tarnished human being. Or to pinch a line from Miroslav Holub, more like a grey, jealous loach, by no means golden. And well, many of you may not relate to that at all. I bet I'm not the only one who sometimes feels like that. At any rate, I don't feel remotely up to the job of saving the world. And while I know that is not in the small print, and I know it's a ridiculous wrong view, it is what I can still turn that ideal into in my head if I don't watch out. Because as humans, we just identify more readily as an individual rather than a process. I mean, we know we are a process, but we identify more easily with being an individual. And as a small human individual who can only ever make individual actions, it's possible to feel a bit ineffective sometimes. But small individual actions that help even just one being are of great value. So, of course, we should resist what can be a bit of a general tendency in the wider world to dismiss them with the argument that they don't make any difference to the bigger picture, so they're not worth doing. You probably all know the beach full of stranded starfish story, where beach full of stranded starfish, and a bloke comes along and sees a kid picking up a starfish and walking out and putting it back in the sea, and says, well, there's no point doing that, that's not going to make any difference to all this. And the kid says, well, it made a big difference to that starfish. And I think it's bigger than that. I think it makes a difference to the world, having people in it that put starfish back, people that care, people that help in whatever ways they can, however small, because they are propelled by love. And I think maybe there's an even bigger picture that is somehow changed by these things. And there's a lovely phrase used in, I think, both Hindu and Zen traditions, who both put a lot of emphasis on just doing something like caring for one plant, which says, how you do one thing is how you do everything. So each small action matters, not just in itself, but because it contains and reveals the spirit of universal cherishing. As an individual with failing physical stuff and energy, I've been feeling increasingly ineffective lately, and I really don't like feeling ineffective. I used to be very effective. I used to do loads. And I know very well that I am measuring, unhelpfully and pridefully, I'm measuring against that past being, but I still don't like it. And on the other hand, I do really also know that my comparative ineffectiveness doesn't really matter. I mean, as long as I'm not just laying around on the sofa eating buns and watching Netflix, it doesn't matter that much as long as I'm doing something, whatever I can manage, however little that is. Even if it's infinitesimal in the scheme of things, it counts. In fact, all of our infinitesimals count, because those infinitesimals add up. And if there's enough of them, they add up to something infinite. There are images of thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara where the main hands are holding all sorts of different things, different implements and objects. And I really like that, because I think it's important to remember we don't all have to be doing the same things to help beings, and certainly not in the same way. We don't even all have to be teaching in the same way, or even the same stuff. I don't ever want the order to get too samey, too regimented in what and how we teach, because apart from anything else, it wouldn't be as effective. Because human beings come in a great variety of forms and feelings, and skillful means having a variety of approaches and styles. But even images where you see those, they're holding different things, all the arms and hands, they all look pretty much the same. They all look pretty good. About the same size, the same elegant shape, same strength, dexterity. So I think we need another image where the arms are all different sizes. Some big, some regular, some very small and thin, a bit withered, some arms in a sling, some with broken wrists, bandaged fingers, missing fingers, joints swollen with arthritis, prosthetic hands. Because no matter how big or small or oddball our abilities, we're all still an important part of the whole action of compassion. And even the strongest, most perfect, most energetic arm with the most dexterous hand can only really be fully effective when it's grounded in the weight of Avalokiteshvara and operates with the energy of and in the context of that pure expression of love. And the order is grounded in and operates in those ways, and in turn we have that same relationship to the order. And I'm very glad to have been able to accept ordination into the particular context of this order, however imperfect it may be, because it's a great context to have. And while I could probably have helped a few people in various ways with the trainings and skills I had before I got involved, I'm sure that I would never have been able to help as many people or as effectively without this context. And I know I have helped quite a few people, some quite radically, and maybe a couple even life-changingly. And that feels really good. And it's fine that it feels good. There should be enjoyment and satisfaction. It's kind of what keeps us going. It feels a bit risky saying that I have helped quite a few people. A bit kind of boastful. But it's true. And I'm sure all of you have done just as much. And I know for sure there are a lot of you here who have done a hell of a lot more. And of course, the reason I can say it is that I have only been able to do it because of learning from others and with the support of others. Each of those thousand arms are supporting each other as well as reaching out to all. There's a tiny little one-line poem by Phyllis April King on an Ivor Cutler album that I like. It's called Not Big Enough. When I was too small to reach, I had a box. And we're all too small to reach on our own, so we have the order. Even with the support of others, sometimes it's really hard work, can be very challenging, sometimes a bit risky, and I often fail. Fail sometimes big, sometimes small. But we all fail sometimes, and that's okay too. As Beckett says, no matter. Try again. Fail again. Fail better. And sometimes there is nothing you or anyone else can do anything about someone's situation. And that's really painful. Apparently, the phrase that all foreign aid workers most want to know the translation of into a foreign language is, I'm sorry, I can't help you. Now, I know foreign aid workers have had a bit of a bad press lately, but basically they're doing bodhisattva work. And it must be so painful to have to say, I'm sorry, I can't help you, over and over again. Oops. So, one last poem. This is by Diane De Prima. I fail as a Dharma teacher. I don't imagine I'll manage to express shunyata in a way that all my students will know and love, or present the Four Noble Truths so they look delicious and tempting as Easter candy. My skillful means is more like a 2x4 banging on the head of a reluctant diver. I then go in and save. What pyrotechnics? Alas, this life, I can't be kind and persuasive, slip the 12-part chain off hundreds of shackled housewives, present the eightfold path like the ultimate roadmap to all the gas stations in Sansara. But oh, my lamas, I want to. How I want to. Just to see your old eyes shine in this Kali Yuga, stars going out around us like birthday candles, your empty, clear, luminous and unobstructed rainbow bodies swimming in and through us like transparent fish. So the one thing that I keep coming back to whenever I feel inadequate about all of this, or whenever I fail miserably, or when I just can't even find the energy to try, is that no matter how impossible or far away or unattainable or unembodiable the ideal of helping all sentient beings seems, no matter how unreal it seems, the wish to do so is real. And that is what matters most. And that's why it is possible and realistic to say yes, for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination.